Hello. On behalf of the Independent Research Forum, welcome to this IRF podcast. I am David Osman, and with me again today is Manoj Pradhan of Talking Heads Macro. Our title for this podcast is An Inflation Regime Change Underway. The Independent Research Forum promotes an extensive range of top quality independent research and alternative data providers from across the world, both macro and micro. Many are global, some are country specific, some sector specific, some stock specific, and all are investment related. In 2020, Manoj Pradhan and Charles Goodhart produced a very influential book, which was entitled The Great Demographic Reversal, Aging Societies, Waning Inequality, and an Inflation Revival. In their book, they predicted that inflation would take off and that interest rates would increase in response to secular trends, such as aging societies and deglobalization. The early 2020s saw a double-digit spike in the rate of inflation, mainly in response to the COVID pandemic and the war in Ukraine. The major central banks are generally expecting their monetary policies to deliver a sustained return of inflation close to target levels in the next year or so. However, these hopes may be disappointed if inflation starts to pick up again. To discuss this issue and more, I'm very pleased that we're again joined today by Manoj Pradhan, who co-founded Talking Heads Macro along with Charles Goodhart in 2016. Manoj, welcome back. Let's begin with a brief introduction to the service that is provided by Talking Heads Macro to your various clients.
Well, first, thanks very much to you and to the IRF for having me back here. I've always enjoyed these conversations. We started Talking Heads Macro out of Morgan Stanley, and one of the things we wanted to do differently was to mix fundamentals and asset prices in a paradigm that I feel has been ignored. So we tried to take a look not just at central bank action or just the data, but to try and look at them together in a global sense from a medium-term point of view. And working with Charles is, as you might imagine, a real pleasure because we really do talk about medium-term events and try and see which one of those could influence what's happening in the near term. And that has been a guiding principle and a very successful one for us. The way we try to look at our coverage is also very helpful because we are global in the sense that we will pick up opportunities where they are available and where the market does not seem to have priced them. So we have no particular domain. Of course, it's important to get the US as right as possible, and China and emerging markets have been providing incredible opportunities, and I don't think that's going to change over a period of time. So the service that we offer clients is to really provide thematic trade ideas that are based on a 3, 6, 9, 12 month outlook, depending on what the underlying driver is, and to try and hold those positions for as long as we think the fundamentals are in place. For example, at the moment, our longest standing trade has been to be long the Nikkei since March of last year. At the end of the pandemic, our longest standing pay position was both in break-even inflation in the US and paying rates in Sweden. And these kind of stories have allowed us to really reap the benefits of global strategies. And I think it's something we really enjoy doing.
Now, in your influential book that was co-authored with Charles Goodhart, The Great Demographic Reversal, which was published in 2020, you identified a number of longer run trends that would cause inflation to pick up in the medium to longer term. To what extent are these factors coming into play this year and next?
Well, one of the most interesting stories that we've seen play out is a bit of a symptom of these underlying demographic stories that we discussed in the book. For example, one of the most astonishing stories out in the global economy that very few people discuss is why, despite the incredible divergence in fundamentals and the incredible convergence in monetary policies, labor markets are so tight everywhere, whether it's Mexico, whether it is the Czech Republic, which has gone through a year and a half of significant tempering of consumption, or whether it's the advanced economies. Everywhere, labor markets have seen an unemployment rate increase of at the most 7 to 8 tenths of a percent, often from historically low levels. And this is despite an increase in immigration and an increase in participation rates. And this is something that we feel is the biggest acceleration of a demographic trend that would otherwise only have happened in 5-10 years from now. And a lot of that has to do with the pandemic. The lack of appetite among governments and among central banks to allow significant recessions to occur has meant that demand has stayed embedded in the global economy, despite what central banks tell us about benign supply shifts and the surge in immigration leading to a large increase in supply. We feel that those factors are tempered by two things. Number one, the unwillingness of firms to lay off workers, knowing fully well that in the future they may have a very hard time hiring those back again, which is a true manifestation of demography really fast forwarded into our times. And the second is the persistent amount of demand that remains through spillovers or through savings from the pandemic that are still with us, which is going to be a feature of the future, because governments will want to try and get reelected and they will want to keep sustained fiscal expansions or at least fiscal spending in place. And you see that tendency anywhere where there are elections. So we feel that some of those longer term trends have in fact transpired and are already with us. Just a brief mention of what those underlying trends were. Broadly speaking, we believe that demography would create three things. Number one, it would create an increase in real interest rates. And the reason it would create an increase in real interest rates was relatively straightforward, that aging means that we dissave. What people don't really pick on yet is that aging comes with a substantial increase in the cost of living, because the longer you live, the greater is the risk for a part of the population to be afflicted with neurodegenerative diseases. And that means some of the dissaving that you might have had to do later in the future has to be done much earlier. Governments have to participate and they have to run larger deficits. As that disinvestment and government spending increases, real interest rates are going to go up. Second, inflation goes up as well. As we have seen in the labor market and in services inflation today, when there is a shortage of labor and labor bargaining power goes up, the ability to keep wage growth at an elevated level is much higher. And that translates one for one into services. At this point in time, as we'll discuss, I'm sure, goods inflation has done a lot of the heavy lifting of disinflation. But over a period of time, as labor markets become tighter and tighter, their input into inflation is going to increase. And effectively, it will be the workers who will have to work twice as hard, because those who don't work, the dependents, the elderly, will still consume, but they won't produce. And that's a net inflationary impulse. A change in both of these will mean that the returns to assets will be difficult to generate, whereas the returns to the labor segment of society will be much stronger, and that reduces inequality over a period of time. Some of those are already beginning to show up. Others may take a little bit longer, but I think we are well on the path towards that outcome.
Do you expect a prospective inflation regime change to have profound effects on markets? And if so, what is the best way to see whether a regime change is or is not priced into the markets? What markers should we watch for to tell us whether such a change is increasingly likely or not?
It's a very good question, and actually one that we can have some concrete points about. Let me take the second part of your question first. So what can we look at if we want to see whether an inflation regime has been priced in? I would think the best indicator for that is US break-even inflation. If you look at US break-even inflation, it has fluctuated a little bit, but it's been remarkably stable after the Fed raised interest rates to a substantial amount. And that tells me that most financial market participants have given the Fed and other central banks either complete credibility or the benefit of the doubt right now, saying they've got a handle on inflation. Yes, it may fluctuate somewhere between 2.5 and 3.5, but that's going to be something that maybe takes a year longer to get back into target. And once they get it back down to target, they will keep it there. I think that's wrong. I think that's wrong for two reasons. Number one, that history, if we look at it with a very clear mind, tells us that the disinflation in the pre-GFC period were at least part of the spectacular rise of China and demographic effects that we've described in the book, which means despite us giving central banks so much credibility and so much of the emphasis in controlling inflation, structural forces had a lot to do with it, and those structural forces are now reversing. And the second part of that story is that that change is happening along with a change in the debt regime. So aging is one really interesting factor that creates a massive divergence in both parts of the debt to GDP ratio. Because advanced economy governments have a social contract to look after its population in a very meaningful way, their commitment to the cause of aging is going to be ramped up over a period of time that will raise debt. GDP growth, as we all know from Econ 101, is a function of labor growth and productivity growth. Productivity growth, if we cannot get AI and other technological tools in place in an aggressive fashion, would probably stagnate after reaching a modestly high point. And at that point in time, we'll have to finance that increasing gap between debt to GDP with inflation. So we are on the cusp of a regime change in inflation. I think the break-even inflation number is the best to see. And if that regime change does indeed occur, I think probably over a 6 or 12 month period, we should start seeing changes in the structure of the break-evens curve in the US. And if the regime change matures, then we should start seeing inflation seep into credit spreads. It should start seeping into emerging market spreads where inflation is a problem and debt is a problem. And most importantly, we should start seeing that in the advanced economies. So thus far, the advanced economies have been spectacularly immune to long-term projections of high interest rates. That will change over a period of time. So the longer end of the yield curves in the advanced economies will start to show higher interest rates for longer. And I think that will be one of the most profound changes we've seen in the global economy. One final point I'll make about the inflation regime is that a key critical mistake that is being made at this point in time is every central bank wants a soft landing. Every central banker wants to protect the labor market from as much damage as possible. There are a few who have spoken about it and spoken up about the role that supply factors can play. But by and large, every central banker would like to keep the unemployment rate as low as possible. Now, the upshot is this. In the Federal Reserve's projections of unemployment, we are peaking just north of 4%, and they want to start cutting interest rates. If the Fed starts cutting interest rates with unemployment peaking at 4.4, 4.5, and they're able to revive demand, which is something that it's clearly not needed, but you get a further boost to it, the unemployment rate may fall to the threes again. And so we never really give disinflation a chance. The very choices that we're making today are helping foster a change in the inflation regime faster.
So after the recent spike in inflation, central bank monetary policies are being critically reviewed by Bernanke, etc. Given the medium-term outlook for inflation that you envisage, is there a danger that the central banks will find their current inflation targets are suboptimal? And if so, could economic growth be unduly constrained?
I think it's entirely possible that happens for a period of time, but there is a very, very, very narrow corridor for central banks to walk. And that's because of the way the fiscal burden, not only of aging, but of political economy, will impact central banking as a whole. So let's see, you see an inflation regime change with a modestly higher increase in inflation. Inflation targets are kept where they are. Central bankers still believe that they can control demand and therefore bring inflation down. They tighten monetary policy at the expense of growth. Growth comes back down, but governments that want to get elected then start using that room to maneuver fiscal policy, and issuance starts increasing. If issuance starts increasing and you bring growth down, it's almost a certainty that we will see mini trust situations pop up over the advanced economies. And that means central banks have a tightrope to watch, because the other task that they are provided with, or they provide us with, is financial stability. So you've got inflation stability on the one hand, financial stability on the other. To hurt inflation from the demand side, you need to bring growth down. But the more you damage growth, the greater is financial stability as a concern, and that could take an entire economy down. It's a very, very, very fine margin. In the past, what had happened was there was a very benign path towards disinflation in the pre-GFC period, which is what everyone has as their models. And that was when structural forces were bringing down inflation. They were raising asset prices. So both mandates of a typical central bank were being met by the same structural force. If that structural force is now acting against you to create an inflation bias, but also a debt bias, you've got a much, much more narrow corridor to walk through. I think it's going to be a very difficult few decades for the central banker.
Given what you're saying about the debt situation, looking at the cost of the COVID pandemic and the ongoing wars in both Ukraine and the Middle East, as well as what you say about the demographic outlook, the longer run prospects for fiscal policies in the G7 economies look to be highly problematic. What might this mean for economic growth, inflation, and monetary policy in those countries?
Well, first, let's take a look at what they mean for debt itself. Now, what's very interesting to both Charles and myself is that if we go to debt agencies of the advanced economies before the pandemic, before this spike in debt, the OBR, the Scandinavian economies, Germany, Portugal, and the CBO in the United States were all projecting a near exponential increase in the debt to GDP ratios, along with a persistent primary deficit. All of those were related primarily to two things. Number one, to a persistent cost of looking after the elderly and an aging society. And number two, a very constant, steady interest rate that, along with a modestly rising primary balance or even a steady primary balance, would lead to an increasing interest cost. It's something that we're struggling with even today because interest rates are high, but even if interest rates were to come back down, but debt was to increase, as the debt to GDP ratio rises, the interest expense behind servicing that debt would go up substantially. So how do you finance that debt? Well, the first and the best way would be productivity. But that remains a very open question. Very recently, there have been a lot of questions around AI, its utilization, its power, consuming capacity, its ability to create real change. We don't know the answers to these questions, and we would be very, very, very happy to be proven wrong if AI turns out to be an absolutely incredible game and life-changing experience, because we'd all be living very well. Barring that, maybe an increase in GDP growth through a combination of productivity and labor incomes would be good. Good old total factor productivity, the way you combine capital. But in a deglobalized world, that's a little bit harder to deal with. So then how do we deal with debt? You can deal with it by using monetary policy to provide investors with a reasonable amount of compensation. You can either provide higher real interest rates that will keep investors interested, or you can allow inflation to run higher, and that would whittle down the real burden of debt. And some combination of the two in the future is inevitable. If that does happen, though, what it implies for financial markets and for growth is quite significant. Number one, growth would have to happen in places where you can release productivity or you can expand. And that would mean in the UK, for example, a lot of the property constraints that you have may have to be released in order to open up new areas for investment. In emerging markets, that would mean that productivity has to be released by opening up different sectors of the economy. Or, as you're seeing in the United States, a redirection of fiscal funds towards productive activities would have to really be the priority of future generations. Without a focus on releasing productivity or directing fiscal funds to not only looking after the elderly, but also to raising productivity and GDP growth, I think you'll find asset returns very hard to generate. So the same factors that keep GDP growth subdued can also hurt asset returns unless governments wake up to a much more difficult future and start using that future as a guiding principle for their fiscal and monetary policies.
When it comes to your investment advice, where do you expect short-term interest rates and 10-year bond yields to be at the end of this year in the USA, the UK, the EU, and Japan?
So the way we have looked at this story has been pretty much along the same lines that you and I have discussed over these last few questions. In fact, since December and January, we've been very skeptical of the central bank's ability to ease rates in line with what the market was pricing. Market pricing has caught up substantially with that story. In fact, there are discussions of a rate hike coming. Might be a possibility, but for that to happen, I think a few things would have to change on the ground. Not only would you have to see a growth impulse, you would need to see China stabilizing a lot faster, which would mean that the goods disinflation and deflation we have seen in the last 6 months, a year, 2 years, would have to dissipate and get into positive territory. That would raise the overall core inflation numbers higher. Then you would be looking at a hike. But nevertheless, what is changing in the economy now is as the story of US exceptionalism gets priced in, and it's gotten priced into quite a deep degree, another regime change looks like it's underway, and that would be the rest of the global economy stabilizing, perhaps growing. If you look at the euro area, there are lots of indicators which seem to tell you that things at the margin are getting slightly better and not slightly worse. Last year's second half was a very poor half for both the UK and the euro area. And this year, the decline in inflation, energy prices have gone up, but the crack spread has narrowed a little bit so that the overall cost of oil hasn't really increased as much. Gas and electricity prices keep coming down, and that has helped firms a lot, and perhaps to some extent, consumers' willingness to spend as well. If that happens and central banks start easing interest rates, you could start seeing a slightly better outlook for growth in the global economy. And that means some of the downward pressure that slowing growth was exerting on 10-year yields could moderate. So I would expect to see 10-year yields in the US, in the euro area, and in the UK, but much more so in the US, remain upwardly biased. I don't think that's a place in which we would look for outright positions. But what's really interesting is in a few places, particularly like Australia or Sweden, there is potential for those bonds to outperform the US. In the second instance, I think what we would expect 10-year yields to achieve in terms of a level is probably hover around somewhere in the 4 to 4.5 range over the next 6 to 12 months. I don't think that's where the juice is. What's really interesting is the ability of some economies, which have done a decent amount of work on inflation, to diverge a little bit more so. It's a very range-bound environment. I'm not expecting anything to change, but what I do expect is where significant amounts of easing are allowed. For example, in the euro area, now we are looking at interest rates 2 years down the line coming down to almost 2.9. I think that's an excessively weak monetary policy outlook. We'd have to strengthen that, but some changes are inevitable. What's the interesting conclusion? The interesting conclusion is that where you can receive rates, they have always to be offset by a paid position. I think in the US, probably the 5-year looks the best to me. The second story that comes out of it is that currencies provide a really excellent story to play a change in the regime. For example, if euro area growth is doing slightly better than it was last year and the ECB has the ability to cut because of disinflation, it becomes something of a pro-cyclical cut, allows the euro to strengthen over a period of time, not weaken as most people believe. And the second one is if you really want carry, the events of the last week in the Middle East have created a ton of volatility in the MXNJPY trade. That's something that I've liked for a while now. And even though we're trading off the lows, both parts of that trade, both central banks have moved in a way that allows me to believe that you will get a substantial amount of return holding on to places in Latin America that provide you a high real interest rate, along with the yen position, which is a very heavy short, but it's a short for a reason. The carry out of those places is substantial. There's no need to do anything crazy, but keep in mind that regimes will change once they get priced in. And that's exactly where we are right now.
Where do you see the best investment opportunities for global asset allocators in the short to medium term? And what would you avoid at present?
The opportunities aren't very different from what I've described over here. I think the best ones always start around a core of paying positions, not as much as we had back in December or January, because look, a lot of the rates trade has changed and we haven't reached a pivotal enough moment for the Fed to start hiking interest rates. But I think there is a range bound story for most central banks that comes in, that come into play. But where I'm looking for opportunities is for a much more selective set of stories where you can receive interest rates in places like Australia, places like Sweden, places like the UK versus paying in the US. And what you've seen over a period of time is that that spread has widened. And that spread has widened because the fundamental downside in these economies is indeed something that needs to be addressed. And there is a dire need for it. Whereas in the US, because of its fiscal position, the incentives for interest rates to come down are just almost non-existent. So that, I feel, is the most fundamentally driven prime opportunity that lies ahead of us. The second one that lies ahead and is also an answer to your question of what to avoid is to avoid a general narrative of dollar strength. First of all, the global economy has diverged so much in its fundamentals that it's impossible to take on a broad dollar story unless we're thinking of a global recession, which no one should be right now. In that spread, Latin America has performed very well in terms of bringing inflation down, but still has more work to do, particularly in Mexico and perhaps because of fiscal in Brazil. Asia has had a very difficult period because of the way China has acted out, but even within that, we've been long India equities for a while. But I think where you can play short dollars, I think wasn't that one opportunity that I mentioned in the euro area. So I feel that there are a select amount of FX trades that can give you enough bang for your buck. When it comes to the rates trades, there are no outright positions that I really like, but some of the spread trades are absolutely fascinating. And from a longer to medium term point of view, if I wanted to hold something, the one thing I would hold is 10-year breakevens. I think without a recession getting priced in and the global economy moving up, that story is going to give us a lot of benefits over the next 12 to 24 months.
Manoj, many thanks for this very interesting insight into the Talking Heads macro service. If we had more time, it would be interesting to discuss in greater detail some of the other aspects of your influential book, The Great Demographic Reversal, particularly your thoughts on the longer run outlook for China, India, and Africa. It would also be interesting to hear more about your views on the most attractive shorter term trading opportunities in the currency, bond, and equity markets. The Independent Research Forum is offering a short trial to the Talking Heads macro service and can provide details of how to subscribe to their full service. More information is available from the Independent Research Forum on request. Thank you for listening to this IRF podcast with Manoj Pradhan of Talking Heads Macro.
Thanks very much for having me here.